So let's get started. Welcome to the last week of class. There's a good side and a bad side to that. I'm sure most of you are feeling right now. I'll do my part to add to that, I'm sure. Speaking of which, we do have a final exam. I tried very hard to make sure everybody knew when it was. I did make a mistake on the initial syllabus I handed out. The one that's on the web should be correct. I sent out lots of emails and try to keep saying this, but I still sort of get emails saying, but your syllabus says such and such. So I don't quite know what to do. So please tell your friends, check with them. Are you going to show up for that exam on Wednesday or Thursday? So I don't know. It's happening Thursday. You can use both sides of an 8.5 by 11 inch sheet of paper to write anything you want on it. If you don't know by now, if that's your form of studying, I mean, be careful. Just making out that sheet isn't sufficient. It will be cumulative. It's actually hard to not be cumulative in this course because it's all sort of built up. At any rate, it will be cumulative. And in that, I mean, we will be covering the stuff that is covered on this week's workshop and problem set. But I will also cover things along the way. So the good news with that is stuff that you're very used to doing now, such as breaking vector into components and things like that, adding vectors together, is actually part of the exam. And we'll be, attempt to do some testing of stuff along the way as if you were just doing that stuff. And what one of the things you'll find as you start studying for this exam, although I'll say it's cumulative and that's a bit scary, as you go back, you'll find that a lot of that stuff now is sort of second nature to you, and many of you will be actually, at this stage, highly embarrassed at some of the stuff you missed on exam one, because some of that stuff now is second nature, and you're just used to it. So I've actually joked with Doug Klein, who has an office next to mine, and I guess you'll get to know him next term, about how it might be fun to take this class, and when you show up for the final exam, say, oh, I'm just kidding, you're actually going to take your final exam in 3 months, because after you've been taking 114, I'm sure if I gave you the physics 113 final exam in March, you'd probably find a lot of it a lot easier than you will now. So, at any rate, sort of sad. If I really was serious about that, I'm sure most of you wouldn't be very happy about showing up for the exam in March. Not to mention the gains, you'd probably give me a hard time. But it might be that it would actually help, because gel time is really important. I did post problem set 11. I sent out an email. Sorry, I just did out. I thought I'd posted it prior to the exam, actually, but I didn't. So, official due date is this Friday. We will not look for the exams in the box until Monday, so that's about all I can do for you. Sorry. I will probably post the solutions Friday, though, because I know there's a short lead time for the final exam. I will have to find a room and try to schedule a Q&A session 1 or 2 days before the exam. And let me actually ask you, would you rather have two choices? Raise your hand for the one you want. It would be 2 days before or the day before? 2 days before? The day before? Okay, so I'll aim to do it 2 days before. There will be issues with room availability probably, but we'll see what happens. I do have a pile of regrade requests, and some people have wanted me to look at some problem sets and stuff, and that has just sat there. I'll try to do it this week. Sorry about that. But anything I'm forgetting you have a question about or an issue with?
Yes?
I haven't seen it. Sorry, I flew back from a meeting that I had to go to last week, last night, so I haven't actually seen it today yet. Nominal goal would have been to have them ready for Thursday. So I guess it's, I haven't heard from them, so I don't know. Anything else? Okay, so last time we started the topic of simple harmonic motions, And physically, to think of some harmonic motion, picture a ball hanging on a string just going up and down. Something that sort of can exhibit that kind of motion is simple harmonic. And in fact, I think strings should guide your intuition mathematically as well, because this now, I hope, is pretty simple for most of you. The force for a spring is restoring force, which is why you have the minus sign. And then as you extend the spring or push the spring in, it pushes back, and the degree to which it pushes back, the force of which it tends to try to restore the system, is proportional to the distance that you stretch it or compress it. So that's what this x is. If I now rewrite F in terms of A in its second derivative form, and then I pull this term over to the left-hand side and divide through by M, I get this particular equation, okay? And this is a second-order normal ordinary differential equation. We're not going to make a science of trying to study these, but when you do study them, you find that you can solve this equation with a harmonic solution like this. So it could be a sine or a cosine. The reason it sort of works is because when you take the derivative of the sine, you get a cosine. When you take the derivative of the cosine, you get a minus sine. So when I take the second derivative, I basically am pulling in a minus sine of whatever the initial function is, so that I basically get the initial function here with a minus sign, and it can cancel out this other term. When you plug the form of this solution in, so if I have an equation that is of this form, whatever the physical system is, if you can go through this type of analysis and make it of this form, okay, just like we did with the spring in particular, then you can write down the solution without doing fancy math. The solution is of this form, and this is a harmonic function. You could use sine or cosine. You have what is known as an amplitude, which is basically the extent of which the ball goes down or back up, so that that the distance from the midpoint of its motion would be called the amplitude. You have the frequency and the phase angle. The frequency is how many times per second it goes through its full motion. You would call the period the time it takes to go through the full motion. And then this angle basically says at t equals zero, where are you in the motion? You define that by this constant, which is called the initial phase angle. If I write this down, it solves this equation if the frequency squared is equal to this constant, okay? So whatever the physical system is, if you can rearrange it so that it looks like this, and you have a constant here, you can then write down a solution, and you know basically whatever it is you're solving for is wiggling, and it wiggles with a frequency that is given by basically the square of the frequency is that constant, okay? So that is simple harmonic motion. What you're looking at is, for example, with the ball moving, x describes where you are along this axis, okay, the position, as a function of time. So that's what this would give you. So that is simple harmonic motion. And if you think of what's happening with time, if I start with the ball up at the top, and then as time increases, it starts falling down, you are doing this, okay? You're going where the spring starts at the top, it starts extending, it goes all the way down. Remember, there's a force upward here, so there's an acceleration upward as it goes past the midpoint, because the spring is now being stretched. And it will slow down and stop at this point as a function of time. This distance we call an amplitude. The time it takes to go through one full cycle of the motion, that is, going from here all the way back up to here, would be known as the period. Okay? One over that is the frequency. If you want to think of it in terms of omega instead of frequency in the form that you have to have in the mathematical equation here is 2 pi over the period. And you can think your way through that in the sense that every time you go through, don't worry about this, let it be zero. Every time you go one period, you want the sign to repeat form. You want this thing to change, to go through, have gone through a whole cycle and come back exactly where it was. So you want this harmonic function to be periodic with that time. And the way that you can get that is to make omega here be 2 pi over the period. So now every time you go through another period, the t over this t becomes an integer. And every time you have an integer times 2 pi, the harmonic function repeats. Okay? You can also think of this whole thing in terms of circular motion. If you now imagine what you would see if you were me and looking at this thing from the side, as this thing goes around angular frequency omega, I would see the ball going up and down, and it would look perfectly simple harmonic motion. Okay, so if you project this onto this axis, or if you project this onto this axis, you will see harmonic motion with a frequency which is equal to the angular frequency of this thing going around the circle. So you can picture it as circular motion, if you will. And that may help some of you be happier with the sort of the notation and the fact that we have an angular frequency there. Okay, so also last time we looked at another example of simple harmonic motion, which is called the simple pendulum. Simple pendulum means that I have a mass and I have something that it hangs from where I can ignore the mass of this. Okay, if I had a big rod, it would be a different thing. But in the simple pendulum, if I just move it around, okay, it is periodic in time. Okay. And we can actually solve for that. We can imagine that we pull it off to the side. We have the force of gravity straight down. We can break it into two components. One is mg cosine theta, which is the force along this direction. And that is basically canceled out by the tension of the rope. Basically, you have to have the rope, the force toward the center be mv squared over r because it's moving on a circle. And then we have the component of gravity which is tangential to this circle, which is pulling it back toward the center here. And so that is your restoring force. So if I just look at the force that is tangential here, it's going to be mg sine theta, and I put in the minus sign because it's a restoring force. So it's pulling me back to where I was. Then break F up into the second derivative of the variable that I'm talking about. As I move this thing out, it's moving along the arc length. So that's the S. And that's equal to minus mg sine theta. And then I actually make an approximation, and I only look at fairly small theta. So I don't do this. Okay, I just do it fairly small. And when you do that, the curve sine theta, which is in red here, and the curve of theta equal theta, which is just this line at 45 degrees, they basically match right in here. And if you're into mathematics, that you could do a Taylor series expansion and keep terms in small powers of theta, and you would find that the Taylor series expansion first term for sine theta is theta. So when you go to small theta, they're equal to each other. We're not going to do the Taylor series expansion, just graphically see that they're roughly the same. So if I go to small angle, sine theta becomes theta. And when I look at this in terms of radian measure, the arc length is L times theta, so I can rewrite theta in terms of S over L. I wanted to do all that to write this in terms of S so that I could see that I satisfy that second order differential equation form that we talked about earlier, where my constant is now g over l. Once I realize I have it in this form, I can immediately write down a mathematical formula for the period, or for the frequency of this pendulum. And that is the frequency squared is g over l. So the frequency is the square root of g over l. Okay. Going fast. We sort of saw this last class. Are there any questions? Yes.
Just for the question. How do you get to be G over L? Because before you have it up as, you get it down to be S over L.
Here's the G. The M's cancel. I rewrite sine theta in terms of S over L, and I pull it over to that side. So here's the G. Sine theta goes to theta goes to S over L. So there's that. So now I have the second derivative of the variable S, and I have the linear term in S, and it is this constant that multiplies that linear term that becomes the frequency.
Okay, thank you.
The square root. Yes.
What's the significance of the W squared equals G over L?
Well, one thing that is significant is my handwriting is horrible. It's an omega, not a W. Okay, so that's angular frequency. The significance of this is when I talk about frequency, frequency is 1 over the period. Period is how long it takes to do one full motion. So frequency is 1 over that, which means this is high frequency, this is low frequency. Frequency, number of times per unit, number of times it could happen per unit time is a way to think about it. And you'll certainly get very used to doing lots of things with frequency. Next term, we'll do a bit more. This term, actually, we'll do a lot with the waves. So maybe you'll get a better feeling for it there. So this is effectively number of vibrations you have per second. So if you're talking about, as we'll see, if we were to look at the motion of a particle on a violin string, for example, this thing, the number of times it goes up and down per second is a measure of its frequency. Okay? As this goes up and down, it hits air molecules that vibrate against your ears, and what the frequency determines what the pitch is that you actually hear in sound. Okay? So things that move at high frequency sound beep, and things that move at low frequency are more rrr. So that's about the extent of my musical talent, I have to confess. Okay, so let us think a minute about simple harmonic motion. Let us imagine that we are looking at a graph that describes simple harmonic motion, and I want to consider what is happening at the point P on this graph. So at a very particular time, it corresponds to this point in time. I would like you to look at the graph and to think for a moment whether the velocity and what is the velocity and the acceleration of that at that point in the motion. Whether it is positive or negative in terms of how they are. So is it positive velocity, negative acceleration, negative velocity, positive acceleration? This is the positive direction for the motion. So I've defined the x-axis to be you can talk it over with your friends if you want. It is number one, raise your hand. Number two. Most of you, three. Not so many. Four. Five. Alright, so most of you said two. So let's think about it for a moment. Time is going to the right. You can think of it different ways. You can look at this and say, well, as time increases, this thing has got to be up here. So it's got to be moving in the positive direction, so positive velocity. Or you can think of this is an xt graph, so the derivative is positive, the slope is positive there. I'm sure most of you were thinking that way, right? Some of you probably were, but that was, yeah. So either of those ways work. Then the acceleration, if you imagine it's a spring, and again, springs are very good intuition for some arm of motion. It may be in a physical system, it's very different, but if you can sort of morph it into your intuition about it into a spring, it can help. So if this were a spring and it's moving up this way, you know that it's being pushed back the other way. So the force would be restoring, so the negative acceleration. So number two would be the way to think about it. Okay, any questions? All right, so we have a simple pendulum like this on Earth. And take it to the moon. How does the period of the pendulum on the moon compare to the period of the pendulum on the Earth? When we analyze the pendulum, omega squared is g over L. Unchanged. How many of you think the period would be greater on the moon? Less on the moon? Okay. So we have sort of a split between these two primarily. It will change because G represents the acceleration of the object at the surface of the Earth, in this case the moon. The moon has a mass that is 1/6 that of Earth. So, well, mass over radius squared is 1/6. So G is 1/6. You don't need to know that unless I were to ask you something quantitative, in which case I'd have to give you the radius of the moon and the mass of the moon, etc. But if effectively G is smaller, so MG is smaller, that's really what you're saying, by 1/6, it says the frequency is smaller. If the frequency is smaller, the period is going to be longer, because you do it fewer times per second. So the period on the moon is going to be bigger than the period on Earth. Okay? Any questions? All right. So I'm going to start a new topic which builds on this one. So it's only a little bit new, really. And it's waves. And a way to think about waves is you can imagine having a particle that's executing simple harmonic motion here. Okay? But if it has a connection to the particles beside it, okay, then if this is executing simple harmonic motion, note that it has to pull the particles beside it with it, basically. And if I have it executing simple harmonic motion, I'll do it differently. Maybe look at this black particle right here. Alright? And what I'm going to do is to basically move this hand in simple harmonic motion, which will then pull the other parts of the string with it. They will move in some harmonic motion, which will pull this, which moves in some harmonic motion all the way down. And if you just look at the black spot there, you'll see it undergoing simple harmonic motion, basically, until it works best until the motion hits that hand and gets reflected, and then it makes a more complicated shape. But okay, so that's sort of the idea. this particular particle undergoes this motion. But because it does this in time, as it pulls the things beside it, they also have to move in simple harmonic motion. But there's a time relation between them. As this goes up, this piece goes up first, then that piece goes up, then this piece goes up. And you'll see this shape actually travel along the stream. Okay? And that's what we call a wave. Waves do not have to be like their simple harmonic motion. They can be like that. Okay? That's not simple harmonic motion because it's not going up and down constantly. The thing is, there's an area of physics which is known as Fourier analysis, which says that I can take any shape of a wave, even a one-time pulse, okay? And I can describe it as an infinite series of sinusoidal waves with varying frequencies and amplitudes. Have you ever heard of a synthesizer? Okay, in music, you can do that electronically with a synthesizer. I can basically just sum up all these different frequencies, so different pitches, with different amplitudes, which means different intensities, and by summing that up, I can produce any sound you want, which is why it's called a synthesizer. Okay? So there's a mathematical theory called Fourier analysis, and the fabulous thing about Fourier analysis is it means we can really understand waves of any arbitrary shape by only understanding harmonic functions. So that's where all of our energy goes, and that's all you need to know. So you can imagine that the waves that you'll have to describe are harmonic waves, which means, you know, something going up and down in time, and each individual point on the wave you can think of as undergoing things. Undergoing, man, I am totally twisted up here. Okay. Alright, so that's basically the idea with the waves. So I'll put in a drawing about that. But let me go ahead. So now what I'd like to do is to take a harmonic wave moving along a string, sort of like we were trying to do just there, and I want to freeze it in time. So we'll imagine our string is sort of where this dashed line is, and now somebody is moving it up and down with some form of harmonic motion. And when they do, you will end up with something that looks roughly like that. And if you look at any individual point on this thing, like right here, it is moving up and down with time in harmonic motion. If I freeze this in time momentarily, so this particle is frozen where it is, it's not actually moving now. This is the distance that we call the amplitude. The spatial periodicity of the thing, that is the distance between the troughs, or the distance between the peaks, is something that we call the wavelength. So usually in this kind of thing, we refer to, if you're trying to sort of picture things, you would refer to this as a trough and this as a peak, for example. This wavelength is sort of true no matter where you are along the curve because everything's repeating. So this distance is also lambda. This distance is lambda. Okay, those are all the same wavelength. And in this case, this is position. So the time that it takes, if I unfreeze time, and you can imagine looking at one of the black pieces of tape on the screen, or if you want to think of water waves, and you can imagine a cork lying on the surface of the water, it goes through one full cycle of its motion in a time which is the period of the wave. So if we unfreeze time, then what you find is that this whole wave moves with a velocity v. This is position here. But now you can imagine this whole shape moving this way with some velocity v. So it's like the shape moving on the string or the water waves moving. So if you can imagine that, and if you want to imagine the cork on the water, so this is still a position graph if you want. This is the displacement up and down, okay, versus position. If we let this go as a function of time, you can sort of think of these as this is a water wave that moves. The form is fixed, and the whole form moves to the right. Okay? And if you think of a cork that's on the wave, it's on the water, it doesn't move with the wave, it just goes up and down, just like the black tape on the screen. So the time with which that goes through one full motion as this whole thing slides through. So you can imagine that a little while ago the cork was at this height, and then it, as this moves this way, it goes up, and then it comes down, and then back up to here. So the motion of the cork itself is like this through one full period. So as this wave slides through, this cork is going to go up a little, down to the other end where the amplitude is, and back up to this. And the time for this motion is the period t. So if you think of that cork as just undergoing some harmonic motion, it's what we already know of as the period. Okay? The frequency is defined as 1 over the period. It is often given the symbol F, particularly for sound and strings, usually. If you're dealing with light, you'll find that it has a symbol nu. So if we want to look at the relationship of the period to the velocity, this is the time over which you get repetition. The wavelength is the space over which you get repetition. So that means this wave has to move one wavelength in one period. Okay? So that means the velocity, wavelength is distance. So the velocity is equal to the wavelength, that's the distance you go in the time that you go. So there's a very fundamental relationship for all waves, which is this. I don't know why. I always think of it as V. Well, no, sorry. This is equal to lambda times the frequency for this if you're thinking of light. Okay, so that's an important relationship we'll have to use for waves. Let me take a wave that is traveling in the x direction. Think of a wave on water, if you will. And let's say the distance perpendicular to the surface of the water is, we'll call y in this case. And let's imagine that we have a water wave that's traveling, and we freeze time, so sort of like we did a little while ago. And let's say that we want to describe it. So if time is frozen, we could say that y, which is a function of x, is equal to the amplitude times the sine of kx. This is a different k, not a spring k. So we can describe this wave in terms of a harmonic function if we make this thing periodic with a wavelength. That is, if I go one full wavelength, I come back to where I started. So harmonic functions are useful in part because that's a property that they have. So if k is equal to 2 pi over lambda, then we can mathematically describe the wave in this form. That means every time we go a distance x, which is a wavelength away from where you were, x over lambda becomes an integer, and you have an integer times 2 pi harmonic function is repetitive of that. Okay? So now, if we have this thing, and we let it move, all right, so in this case, it moves as some function of time with some velocity, okay? Then you can also imagine that y is equal to the amplitude times the sine of some of frequency times time. That is, if I look at a point on the water, the cork on the water goes up and down with a frequency that is the harmonic frequency of this thing. I can describe it in terms of a harmonic function if omega is 2 pi over the period. So that you've already seen. So harmonic, simple harmonic motion is basically as if you're just looking at one point on this wave as the wave goes through. Okay? You're looking at one point like the cork. You're just looking at the motion of that one cork. So that equation is basically simple harmonic motion. So the thing is, if we want to describe a wave, we have both this variation in space and this variation in time happening everywhere at once. So we have to sort of pull it all together. So a way to do that, let me motivate it backwards. Let me tell you how to write it. So y of xt for a wave is equal to a times the sine of kx minus omega t. And this would be a wave that's moving to the right to positive x, to the right for you. And if I write y is of x and t is a sine kx plus omega t, v is going to the left or toward negative x. All right, so how do I know that?
If we don't worry about the plus or minus at the moment, how do I know I have this form? I know I have this form because if I sit at x equals 0, I know I have to be executing simple harmonic motion with time because the cork is sitting at x equals 0. So that's why I know that I have to have the omega t in here. And omega is just like we have here. It has to be 2 pi over the period. If I freeze things at t equals 0, and I look at how it varies with space alone, I know I have to go as kx. Okay? It has to be harmonic like a sine. As I go out another wavelength, I have to come back to where I was. So k is 2 pi over omega. So I have to have this basic form, and now we have to worry a little bit about this sine, this plus or minus in the middle, and how do I know it goes to the right or to the left? Well, let us imagine this shape moves this way with velocity v. So I can ask, what is the velocity of a fixed argument here? So let me, if I want to sort of look at just this point on the sine curve and follow it as it moves with the velocity v, I can ask, what is, if I were to take the shape and let it slide and I now pin a point to that shape, I can ask, what is its velocity? When I want to fix a point on the curve, I basically am fixing this argument. So I'm saying for constant phase of the harmonic function, what is its speed?
So to have that, phase is the argument of this harmonic function. Okay. So if I say I have constant phase, what it means is, let's look at the one moving to the right, or that I think is moving to the right, kx minus omega t. Let me take the derivative of that with respect to time, because that's what I mean by velocity. That's going to be equal to k times the derivative of x with respect to t minus omega, derivative of t with respect to t is just 1. If this is equal to a constant, so I want to basically look at the speed with which the shape moves. This is a constant. It means when I take the derivative of both sides, this is 0. So I have that dx over dt is equal to plus omega over k, which is plus 2 pi over t over 2 pi over lambda, which is equal to lambda over t, which is the velocity. So when I have a minus sign here, okay, then I get a positive v, which means I'm going to the right the way that we've drawn. If I have a negative sign there, I get a positive v. If I have a positive sign here, it flips this sign, which means I get a minus v. So it goes the other way. And that is why when I write it this way, I have v going to the right, and when I write it this way, I have v going to the left. Or left means minus x. Okay? A, again, represents the height and depth of the wave. From the top of the peaks to the bottom of the troughs would be 2 times the amplitude, 2 times the phase. All right?
you know, I'm doing a good job of disguising it, but we have to sort of have the backgrounds. But waves are actually really cool and a lot of fun, and I hope I have time to do enough of it that you'll actually agree with me on that. A little bit more we have to do. What we have been visualizing, and I do think it is the simplest thing to visualize, is waves that move in such a way that the particles are moving transversely to the motion of the wave itself. And this is what's known as a transverse wave. Okay, so the water, from the water wave, the cork moves transverse to the motion of the wave. On a string, I do this, the wave goes that way, but the motion of each particle on the string is up and down. Okay, so that's transverse. Up and down has nothing to do with it. It's up and down when I'm doing the string, but it could be this way or whatever. You can have waves where the motion of the particle is like this and the wave itself moves this way. I forgot to ask for the demo, but how many of you have played with Slinkies? Many of you. So Slinky is like this really nice sort of loose spring sort of thing. Okay? And you take a Slinky and you hold it out like this, you sort of think of it as a stretched spring. And if I take the Slinky and I compress it in a little spot here, and I let it go, then I have a highly dense area of strain here, and it's light here, and this shape moves down the Slinky like this. So you actually have a wave that moves along the Slinky, where the wave is not displacement this way, but it is displacement along the motion of the wave. Okay? And if you've not seen one of those, I'll try to remember to bring one to class next time. In sound, if you can imagine what's happening with a string instrument, the string moves. When it moves, it hits molecules of air, which get compressed a little bit. As the string goes down, it pulls away, and these molecules of air have a high density. They then spread out, and you'll have a higher pressure up here, lower here. Then it'll keep going, and you'll end up with a longitudinal wave and density of the air. And that's what we call a sound wave. Okay? Those waves, because the air molecules, if I have a string vibrating like this, this air molecule is just doing this. So the wave, the density varies as a function of distance away from the string, and we call that because the particles are moving in the direction of the wave, so you can imagine having the string vibrating like so, you get a density function in the air that sort of goes like this, where the density of dots gives you a sense of the pressure, is what I'm trying to do, the density of the air. And the particles themselves are vibrating this way, and the wave itself, that is this pattern of denser and more rarefied regions of air, is moving outward like that. And so this is what's known as a longitudinal wave. A longitudinal wave. So think of a Slinky. And sound happens to be a longitudinal wave. Okay, so another little thing we need to know about waves is, if waves depend a lot on the medium in which they travel. if I pull up with a force here, the reaction of what happens down here depends on the medium itself. If it's really heavy for a given force, I have a smaller acceleration. If this is accelerating less quickly, then the motion is going to be slower, and the overall shape of this thing is going to propagate more slowly, because it basically, as the wave moves, these particles have to move. They move in response to the force of the neighboring particles. So if that response is slower, that is, there's a lot of mass or something in here, then the wave will move slower. Okay? So I get, you sort of get a sense of how fast that goes. I don't think this is going to be too short, probably. But if you hold that, I'm going to try to do basically the same motion here, and it moves a lot faster. I don't know if you can really tell. Okay. So I have a device here which is designed to show you this. Instead of a string, what I have is a stiff wire, a very stiff wire. And to this wire, I have connected transversely pieces of metal. Okay? So now I can move a piece of this metal up and down, and it is connected to its neighbors by this tense, this very stiff wire. As I twist the wire here, it will twist the neighbors next to it, okay? So if I twist it a little bit, you can see this doing that. So I can make a wave. Can you see that, Bob? Okay, so there's a wave. Now, here I have long pieces of metal. So you can think of the medium as being very heavy, hard to move. Here I have short pieces of metal. So the same stiff wire, so it's easier to move these than it is those. Okay? So now I want you to notice something. As the wave comes to the end of this medium, it will hit this other medium. The wire is twisting, so it will twist this one too. So the wave will actually go into the other medium. I want you to pay attention to the speed of the wave here and the speed of the wave here, and think of them as relative to one another. What did you see? Slow, fast. Okay? Because for a given motion, it now can move much faster. So there is very much a dependence on the medium for any wave. If you made a lake out of molasses, the waves would be much slower than water, for example. Right? If you have a heavy string, the waves will propagate more slowly than a very light string. It's also true that if the string is very tight, if I move this up a little bit, I get more of an effect further down. If it's a very loose string, I can move this quite a bit before I get much of an effect over here. So the speed of the wave will depend on, if you're talking about, in particular, if you're talking about strings. And one way to think about that, you may say, well, I don't give a crap about strings. If you like music, you do, right? Because that's all music is vibrating strings for the most part on surfaces. So if I have this loose, you sort of get a sense of the speed. Hold it tight. If I tighten it up, it's a lot faster. You see that? Okay, so there's a dependence on the medium, that is the mass that you're moving around, and a dependence on the tension if you're on the string.
So the velocity of a wave, I'm not going to bother deriving this for you. The velocity of a wave on a string is equal to the square root of the tension over mu. Mu is... God, how horrible is that? It is a linear mass density.
You might think I should call it lambda, since that we've sort of used that in the past. I'm not sure why. I believe the standard symbol for this particular linear mass density is mu, so you may see it either way. And this is tension in the string. So a heavy string has a big mu, and the velocity is small. Okay? A light string has a small mu. So if I were to take the string and cut out, you know, a unit length of it and measure the mass, that's what I mean by the mass density. If it's a heavy string, you'd have a lot of mass there. With sound, you have the variations like so, and what we're really talking about is high and low pressures, and you have the velocity, you have some speed. And in this case, so this would be high pressure, and this would be low pressure. The velocity of the sound in this case is given by the square root of B over the density. All right, so B is what is defined as the bulk modulus, and this is the volume density.
Bulk modulus basically is a description of how easy it is for the particles to move within the medium. It's something you would look up. I'm not going to be deriving it for you. So something that, where it's hard for the particles to move because they're really connected very tightly, you would have a large bulk modulus. Something where the particles move very easily, you would have sort of a small bulk modulus. And it will depend on the density of the particles in the medium. So you'll find out certain things, like the speed of the sound will travel, will be different depending on the temperature of the day. If the motion of the string is the same, that is, the frequency is the same, the speed varies, that means the pitch you hear is going to depend on the temperature of the day. I'm not saying that right. We'll come to that. All right, so the point is that the wave characteristics will depend on the medium itself. So now a lot of the fun with waves happens when they hit boundaries. And you have to give me a moment to get there, but just to underscore how what I really mean. If I pluck a string on a guitar, what I'm doing is I'm creating a wave that goes from one boundary to another. And the thing about waves is waves do something we call interfere. If you can imagine you're in a wave pool, waves, we call it superposition. So let's imagine we have a string where I have a wave pulse traveling this way and a wave pulse traveling that way. As these pulses hit each other, what will happen is they'll add together an amplitude, like that, and then they'll pass through each other and continue on their merry way, unaffected. I can take the same thing, and I can have a pulse like this traveling on a string, encountering a pulse the other direction, going that way. And when they hit each other, these two will cancel out, and then they'll move on their merry way. This is what's known as superposition. It is
very fundamentally important characteristic of waves. If you're in a big wave pool or you're at the ocean or something and you're just sort of drifting in the waves as they come in, sometimes you'll note that you'll have a big wave coming this way and then like nothing happens because you had some trough coming this way and they just add together and cancel out. And other times, you know, one wave here will hit you at the same time another wave sort of hits you and you go way out. Right? So you've felt this a lot, I'm sure. So all waves are like that. And it's a way of saying that they interfere. So in this case, we would have fully destructive interference. And here we would have what's known as fully constructive interference. So to understand what happens with music in particular, but it's true for all waves, I want to look at waves and what happens to them as they go through boundaries. So by a boundary, I might mean sort of a place where the medium changes. So this point is a place where the medium for this stream changes. It goes from very heavy to very light. Okay? As I tie this thing, if I hold it on one end and hold it on the other, the wave also has to hit my hands. And so you have to ask me what happens in all of these various places. So, if I have a heavy string tied to a very light one, and I imagine that I have a pulse traveling like so, I have this big heavy thing moving when the pulse gets there, and it's going to drag the light one along very easily. Okay? So, I hope it makes sense that you would have here a transmitted wave, which has the same sense of the wave, what I mean by that. Imagine I have a harmonic curve and it's moving this way. This harmonic curve where this goes into this has the same phase because the phase basically just keeps moving. It has the same sense. If the thing is moving up, as it gets to this other thing, it will be moving up. And so as it propagates on, the basic shape will go sort of, it look the same. This is an incoming wave. So I have an incoming wave. It hits the boundary. The boundary is up high. Some of the energy will get reflected off the boundary, and you'll have what's known as a reflected wave. And the reflected wave, if this thing is very heavy, will basically have the same sense as well. So the pulse that's reflected will have the same phase. If I have the wave coming in from the other side, it will have a transmitted wave. As the light string goes up, it will pull the heavy string up. This is sort of hard to do. But I will have a transmitted wave that has the same sense, the same phase. But now what changes is as this wave comes in for the light stream, remember it's going very fast, and it hits this heavy piece of the string, and it can't move it very fast. So what will happen is this wave basically will flip as it goes the other way, so that the incoming wave and the outgoing wave sort of cancel each other out, because that's the only way you can have the big thick string not move very much. So that means at the reflection from a light medium to a heavy medium, the reflected wave has the opposite sense, or we say it has a 180 degree phase change. Right, if this is my sine curve, if I flip it by pi, if I take the argument and I increase it by pi or 180 degrees, it has the opposite sign. So that's why we call it a 180 degree phase change. Physically, it means it comes in with the opposite sense. This is going to be true for any type of wave. And a way to think about it is if I go from a fast medium to a slow medium, that is, from a light medium, easy to move, or a low mass per unit length to a high mass per unit length, then you have a 180 degree phase change for the reflected wave. And if you go from slow to fast, or high mu to low mu, then there's no phase change. In this language, the wave moves slowly here. So this is the slow medium, fast medium. All right? Now, what's going to happen is I'm going to create a wave here, and it's going to come, and it's going to split here. You're going to see some of the energy go this way in the wave, and some will be reflected. All right? So just notice that happens. Okay? Now, if that happened, note the sense. This is up, 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 up. So there's no phase change as it goes through this interface from high to low. Note what happens for the reflected wave. Sorry, I did it with my arm. It's up, and it stays. It hits my finger. Okay. And it stays up. So the reflected wave has the same sense. Now, look at what happens when I do this. You're going to see the wave split again. First, let's look at the wave as it propagates on the heavy medium. Stays up. Now, if you can see it, it's going to be fast. I want you to look at this wave coming in and then look at it reflect. Could you see that? You're welcome to get up. Sorry. At this interface, it's really hard to see because it's moving fast, but at this interface, the wave that's coming in with this sense goes back out with the opposite sense. So that's what we mean by the 180 degree phase change. And it has to be that way because basically, if you think of it momentarily when it reflects, this piece is having a hard time moving fast enough. So it doesn't. Which means the incoming wave and the outgoing wave have to add together to effectively be nothing, which means they have to interfere with the opposite. One has to be up this way, one that way, so they add together to be effectively nothing at that point. Okay, so if we have a string and we say we tie it at both ends, for example, then we can try to figure out what's going to happen with the string. If I have a string tied, we say it has a fixed end. What it means is this incoming wave, when it reflects, it has to add together with the reflected wave at the interface in such a way that they cancel out completely because the string is tied at the end. So that means that the outgoing wave upon reflection has to have a 180 degree phase change. Or a way to think about it is you're going from a medium that has some speed, it's fast, to an infinitely slow medium, which is what I mean by tied it to the point, right? So it's completely fixed. So when you have a fixed end, the wave that comes in is reflected with a 180 degree phase change. If I have the string set up so that it basically is free to move, now the wave comes in and it moves the end of the string up, which then comes back down, and so the reflected wave that comes back has no phase change. So why do you care? Because if you pluck a guitar string, what you're doing is you're creating a wave on the string, and this wave moves, it hits an end, and is reflected. And it is the superposition of these two waves that gives you the characteristics of how this thing will vibrate in the long term. So it will determine the characteristics of the vibration. So to understand, for example, how a string instrument works, we have to interfere the propagating wave with its reflected wave and look at the characteristics of that. And what we'll find is out of that, only particular types of vibration for a given mass and a given tension and a given length of a string, only particular frequencies of vibrations will sort of add together. Others, you'll have the incoming and the outgoing, and they'll sort of cancel out or be a bit messy. So the things that add together, we say, resonate, and those are the very particular frequency of vibrations that will play well on that string. So that's the frequency that you get when you pluck that string, for example. Okay? So not just any wave for a given set of conditions will play well. And so when you tune an instrument, what you're doing is you will change the tension, or you can change the mass per unit length of the string, or you can change the length. And if you do any of those things, you change the frequency of the things that will sound good on that string. So you change its pitch. Right, so if you are playing a guitar and you just pluck it, it will have a certain sound because that's the sound that will vibrate nicely. If you then touch it, you can effectively change the length, if you will. So that's sort of how you can change when you play a guitar. But anyway, we'll look at that very carefully next time. Any questions?